Do vaccines provide net benefit in the context of public health? That's the crux of the debate always. It's also the question I address in the big picture. So let's look at the big picture that involves infant immunity and brain function. This picture is designed to show you how I see a baby and its potential downfall. If you want your baby to have a chance to grow up to be healthy with all of its cogs functioning normally, you should make sure that nothing interferes with the immunologic programming, especially during the first 3 years of life. Anything eaten, injected, breathed, for instance, which creates damage or stress, has the potential to change the DNA instruction manual of protein synthesis and lead to system malfunction. After 21 years of being a medical doctor, working as a kidney specialist for part of that time, and teaching in academic institutions for part of that time, and studying the science intensively, especially over the past 4 years, and my recent years of listening to the disenfranchised parents of wounded children, it's my conclusion that the most efficient way to destroy a life is to indiscriminately agree to use everything considered best practice or gold standard in the aggressive interventionist medical model of today, which is often based on reductionist science, produced by industry and encouraged by government agencies. The medical system used to consider the first months of pregnancy developmentally vulnerable, though that appears to have gone out the window with new directives in the United States to vaccinate pregnant mothers with a variety of vaccines, most of which contain aluminum. So looked at from a purely biological and immunological perspective, though, the three-year pregnancy, as we call it, must be considered. This is a schematic that a friend and myself came up with together when we were thinking about this. Some medical researchers are starting to see that there is a highly orchestrated, amazingly intricate metabolic and immune system blueprint, which is highly influential upon the normal growth and development of brains and immune systems. And that's what's at stake here, right? Brains and immune systems. The microbiome, which is all the bacteria and viruses and fungi that are supposed to be living in you and on you, the immune system and the nervous systems are interdependent and intimately related. The strengths and weaknesses of that child in their future lives are determined in part before gestation by the health of the parents and the diet of the parents, during gestation by what the mother is doing and by what the medical system is doing to the mother, what she's thinking and how she's feeling, and during the first 2 years of that baby's life after it's born. That's what I call constituting the three-year pregnancy, which is depicted schematically here. So this whole circle is the three-year pregnancy. This denotes the period of time before conception, where it's been shown that the diet, even of the father, has an impact on how that baby will turn out. And then we have the pregnancy period here. And this is a continuum, because once pregnancy starts, there's a shift in the mother's immune system. And it's basically to create a balance so that that trophoblast doesn't invade through her, and that so she doesn't reject it at the same time. So her immune system basically goes anti-inflammatory. And the whole goal during this situation is to keep that baby anti-inflammatory. And so the microbiome of the mother is key to that. Then towards right before birth, she shifts into a pro-inflammatory situation, and her microbiome changes again. And that is key to triggering labor, actually. Then we have birth, and at that point, there's another shift to dampen down all the catecholamines and the inflammation that's necessary to have a normal, healthy vaginal delivery. Then we have the 2 years afterwards, and we have continuation of the mother's immunity. They're still connected, and the breast milk takes over. And so we have the infant gut microbiome that has to be established, and that's extremely important that that happens on time and with the right microbes, and it's not interfered with antibiotics, just in case, for all sorts of situations to the mother and the baby. And then towards the end of that, the baby graduates, and the baby actually, his immune system will turn slightly pro-inflammatory, and that's where we live during health, and there are reasons for that. I don't have time to get into the details of it today, though. So this is what I'm going to be talking about today, so if you didn't take all that in right now, don't worry, because I'm going to be repeating myself over and over, and because this is filmed, and you can go back and watch it later. Most of my slides will have PMID, PubMed numbers, on them, where you can actually go and get the articles that I'm referring to. At the core of this is a factory inside every cell responsible for listening to, responding to, and sometimes defending itself from its environment. And it's not all about genes. There's a revolution in genetics and biology that's reshaping the way scientists once thought about inheritance and our genetic fate. It's a game changer. The epigenome is the conductor of the blueprint manual. DNA is just a blueprint. It has no activity by itself, okay? So epigenome means above the genome, and this is a whole system of signals which either tightens and shuts down or opens up and activates sections of DNA to make proteins, which can produce different results depending on the signals they receive from the outside world. Those signals can come from drugs, food, chemicals, social stress, and even the predominant tenor of an individual's thoughts. And epigenetic changes are also inheritable. Scientists used to think that the slate was wiped clean during conception, but now we know that epigenetic changes that happen to your baby or that happen to your grandmother can be passed down and can magnify with each successive generation. Obviously, this doesn't just apply to humans. It applies to animals, and it's most quickly seen and recognized by home gardeners. Here is a really obvious example of epigenetic differences. These are two different plants with the same genetic seed planted the same year. This is an Italian tomato called a Capri. The seeds are the same. The big difference is the quality of the soil, the watering, and the sun levels. And the outcome, as you can see, is dramatically different, even to the untrained eye. This plant here might get 10, 20 tomatoes if you're lucky. This one had over 100. What tomato plants get to eat has a huge bearing on how they grow. And the same applies to animals and to humans. All mammals have a gene called agouti, but that gene can become mutant. And when a mouse's mutant agouti gene is completely unmethylated, its coat is yellow like that, and it's obese, and it's prone to diabetes, cancer. And when the agouti gene is methylated, and I'll tell you in a minute what methylated and unmethylated is, the coat color is brown, like this one here, and the mouse has a low disease risk and is also thin and normal shaped. So fat yellow mice and skinny brown mice are genetically identical, okay? The fat yellow mice are different because they've had an epigenetic change that occurred from the amount of B12 and folate and choline that the mother ate while she was pregnant with this mouse. Okay, so she didn't get enough folic acid, vitamin B12, and choline. This agouti mutant will end up like this, and if she gets enough, this one is what will come out. So this is an example showing how genes are activated, and it's a more common issue than the genes themselves and just what's in the DNA. So what denotes environment? This is a really important question because anything outside your cells actually constitutes environment. So whether it's inside or outside your body. And variations in the environment can make an instant change. Just as folic acid, B12, and choline make big changes in these mice, environmental changes in a pregnant woman can do exactly the same thing. To start to understand what makes a healthy child, we have to understand that the old central dogma that many of us may have learned in college, I did, for instance, that our genes control us, that's not true. Our genes don't control us. They are readout manuals with lots of different options dependent upon the owner. DNA is only responsible for about 10% of how we turn out. You know all that junk DNA we were told about? Well, guess what? It's not junk. And blueprints, like DNA, have no activity or power on their own. They're controlled from outside. So let's get rid of that old dogma and let me show you this. And I'll explain this, so don't worry. What this is a schematic of a cell. So imagine this membrane going all the way around like this. And then inside you have cytoplasm and with all kinds of miraculous things going on. And then you have the nucleus at the very center inside. And this is the genetic material, the DNA, all right? Each cell membrane of every one of your cells has around 100,000 protein switches that open and close to various substances and send signals inside depending on what's happening out here, the environment. Signal transduction is what this is called, and it's key to when and which proteins are made in the cell and how that cell will function. Our environment does most of the controlling through these cell membranes. Thus, the nucleus is not the brain of the cell, like we used to think. In fact, some cells live for up to 2 months with no nucleus at all. But no cell lives without a membrane. If you interrupt these processes in the membrane, the cell will become dysfunctional. Death or life messages can be sent through those membranes into the nucleus, and that's what determines whether you grow normally, grow wrong, or mutate. 90% of what comes from the blueprint of your genes is controlled by what the cell surface encounters. The broth your cells are exposed to can be stress hormones or endorphins, nutrients or starvation, inflammation or non-inflammation, and on and on. So what made the difference in those agouti mice was not their mutant genes, but how those genes responded to the environment their cells were bathing in, whether those cells were marinating in proper nutrients or not. That's the basis of epigenetics. DNA is typically represented by the double helix, as you're probably all familiar with, and there are three main mechanisms by which genes are epigenetically expressed or suppressed. It's called DNA methylation, which is right here. So let's just go over this. This is what a chromosome looks like when it's all curled up inside the nucleus. But if you uncurl this, it's probably miles long. And then you uncurl it, and then it comes, this is a secondary form right here. And then it uncurls even further. And then these little things are coils inside that are called histones. There's a big one right there. And then that can uncoil even further. And then this is what you're used to seeing as the double helix. So we've got lots of twisting going on here and covering up. So most of the DNA is inside, and it's not accessible until it's woken up and told what to do, okay? So the main mechanisms are methylation, and methyl is just it's a chemical group that can sit on here, and it sits on a particular base and will either activate the gene or tell it to stay asleep. Then we can have acetylation of these histone proteins, or the coils. And it's kind of like your garden hose, actually, you know, how you can wind it up. And so if this becomes acetylated, then this unwinds and the DNA becomes exposed. And then we have something really miraculous and amazing, and this is microRNA. And this is another revolution in understanding of genetics that's going on today, because microRNA is everywhere. It's in breast milk, it's in cow's milk, it's in food, it's in the placenta, and has all kinds of activity that was previously unappreciated. So how or when any of this epigenetic alteration occurs is largely dependent upon what that cell membrane is encountering. Here's what can happen to genes in the nucleus after the membrane is stimulated. In which areas are the epigenetic effects prominent? Well, pretty much everywhere. Health problems rarely occur in isolation. They exist as part of a pattern or superstructure of health risks across a lifetime. Every word on this slide has an impact on epigenetics. I don't have time to talk about all of it today. I've researched thoroughly. I've got papers to show just about every one of these things is true. So this is just a brief overview of how a baby's immune system develops and what might happen if you put vaccines into that. That's what we're going to talk about today. But vaccines aren't the only factor, and that's what I want to point out here today. Stress from any source on this slide are all shown to be highly influential in a neonate's development. Epigenetic factors play a huge role and are unappreciated role in disease development, also in how drugs affect you or how vaccines affect you, that can no longer be ignored because the science is blossoming over the importance of the cell environment. If a mother makes this choice, a baby can be programmed into an inflammatory phenotype, meaning how they look from the outside, how they're expressing and living. But this choice can do the opposite. Parents often don't know what they need to know in order to make the best choices because they don't get to hear the voices which can inform them so they can make different choices. Parents are mostly maneuvered into a one-size-fits-all medical model, but parents have to live with the consequences of their choices. When it comes to conventional medical care, vaccines, and so many interventions, not only are most medical doctors not informed about the biochemical results of their daily practice, I certainly wasn't, but they often adamantly deny the effects of their interventions and seem hardened to the consequences of what they deny or don't understand. And I know there are parents in this room that can testify to that fact. For parents to make ideal choices, they need to know what the biological foundations really are. Normally at this point, I'd spend some time talking about pregnancy and some of the amazing things that happened during those 38 weeks, but I can't do that today. But I do want to mention one particular thing because it's crucial to discussion later on, and that is the factory inside the mother that makes the baby. Babies are built out of stem cells, which are crucial to the future of the baby's immune system and future life. Our longevity and our health is based in part on how many stem cells and the quality of them that we get at birth and how long they survive in the body. There was recently a study of a 115-year-old woman, and they looked to find out, she donated her body to science, and they found that she was still living on two lines of stem cells to make her blood. The placenta is a masterpiece of construction, orchestrated by stem cells and churning out millions of stem cells into every crevice and even into the amniotic fluid, where those stem cells orchestrate the lung and gut integrity. In utero, the baby breathes, swallows, and urinates stem cells, as well as having them transported inside via the umbilical cord. There are about 80,000 stem cells in 2 mLs of amniotic fluid. However, at birth, the baby should receive a massive stem cell infusion from the cord blood. An immediately cord-clamped baby is deprived of its own property, which is approximately 8 million stem cells. The problem today is that many obstetric staff have lost their grasp of core physiology, so that even in 2014, hospital doctors and nurses often have never seen or done a delayed cord clamp. The function of these stem cells at birth is to dampen down the effect of the very high catecholamine stress hormones, which are actually vital to jumpstarting that baby's immune system at the time of birth. The stem cells allow for a seamless transition in the baby for the next steps into life, one of which is the establishment of the gut and body microbiome, all those microbes. Profound anemia also results from immediate cord clamping. Up to 40% of that baby's blood can be left behind, and it's a contributor to much illness and infants today. Amazingly, even today, there are many in the obstetrics world who are uneducated and into thinking that a baby is in a privileged, sterile environment up until birth. This is what I was taught when I was doing obstetrics. But through DNA fingerprinting, we can tell that microbes are in the placenta, the amniotic fluid, the umbilical cord, and many other places, including meconium, which means that the baby has been exposed throughout pregnancy to microbes. What we have here is meconium samples of 4 different individuals. This is an adult for comparison. This is a baby from a healthy mother. This is a baby from a mother who had gestational diabetes. This is a baby's meconium from a mother who had type 2 diabetes. And this is just the color coding of the different microbes. And what you can see is that they're very different from person to person, depending on, actually it's group to group, depending on the status of the mother. One of the most important elements of a healthy child is a healthy microbe profile in the mother and the baby. And that's dependent on doctors understanding what normal really is and understanding what else they can do besides napalming the gut of the mother and tossing antibiotics into a situation when they don't need to be. The key for a mother and a baby is that the baby's immune system is about to be taught how not to respond, to develop tolerance over a period of time, so that it learns in a protected environment what's safe and what's not. And again, the key to this education of that baby is the mother. The maternal microbiome changes during labor, as I just mentioned, to become anti-inflammatory. Changes during gestation to be anti-inflammatory and then becomes inflammatory at labor. And then it changes during the feeding process, as I mentioned to you. So the baby is brought into anti-inflammatory after birth, where they'll stay for 2 years with that slow transition into a slightly pro-inflammatory profile. Mother's milk continues to maintain the baby anti-inflammatory, just like the placenta was. Antibiotics, antifungals, poor diet with low minerals, low fiber will put the mother-infant dyad at a disadvantage at any point before or during this period. This schematic here shows us the different colonization times of the infant based on its age. The major task of a baby's immune system is to know when not to respond. All of our immune systems right now are constantly sampling and screening material from within our own tissues and also from the exterior. And 99.99% of the time, it has to make the decision not to mount an immune response. A well-developed anti-inflammatory immune system is dependent upon microbial balance. Which bacteria dominate during the initial colonization process is very important, as is the stepwise introduction taking place at the right times. And we can see the shifts of the different bacteria that come in later. Whether or not the colonization process happened on time and appropriately can impact allergies, inflammatory bowel disease, autoimmune disease, and brain function. This is well documented in the medical literature. There are three classes of bacteria. One are called commensals, which you're probably familiar with. They're residents of the bowel and the body that don't cause any harm, but they don't really help. Then there are other ones called symbionts, which are residents that actually give benefit. And then there are microbes called pathobionts. They're residents that can cause disease under certain circumstances. For instance, Clostridium bacteria are actually very beneficial. We need them. But if we throw antibiotic into the system, what happens is their competitors are decreased, and then they can overgrow, and then they become problematic. That's an example of a pathobiont. But note that all of these bacteria are residents, normal residents, and that balance is the key. This one here, Bacteroides, is a symbiont, meaning that it gives benefit, and it helps keep inflammation down. And as you can see, it's one of the first colonizers of that baby. So not only do antibiotics affect this pattern, but any kind of repetitive and constant stress or vaccination and the mode of delivery and even the mode of feeding can affect how this happens. Until relatively recently, it was assumed that microbes in human milk were contaminants from the mother's skin and that human milk was sterile. But when they collected milk under aseptic techniques, bacteria were still found. So scientists were mystified, and they decided to look at the microbial DNA fingerprint and were astonished to find that human milk bacteria had different DNA fingerprints when compared to that mother's skin bacteria. A vaginally born baby gets its first gut flora bolus transplant from its mother's vaginal flora, which is hugely complex. And this is flushed down into the gut by pre-colostrum, clear fluid, and then that's followed by colostrum bolus, and then ends up in mature milk, which still continues to have microbes in it. There are approximately 10,000 bacteria per ml in aseptically collected human milk. But that's only part of the story. The milk that looks like a white liquid is actually a live transplant made from the mother's own blood. Human milk is a pulsing living organism, which has one main function outside of food, and that is to keep everything in the baby as much as possible anti-inflammatory. Breast milk has substances which stop pathogens attaching and other substances which go after invading pathogens and butcher them to pieces. Development of the intestines and mucosal immunity and growth of many of that infant's tissues are mediated by human milk. That master butcher that I mentioned before is called Hamlet. It stands for human alpha lactalbumin made lethal to tumors. It kills tumors. It's being used by the oncology industry, or they're attempting to anyway, to treat cancer. But it happens to also be lethal to pneumococcus and encapsulated bacteria. Now, if you think this is a long list here of what's in milk, look at stem cells, microRNA, messenger RNA, we've got erythropoietin making blood, we've got factors that make bone and orchestrate bone, we've got food for the baby, we've got food for the microbes, there's all kinds of stuff going on there. But this is actually a really short list. Because every time scientists look with new technology, not only does the list grow longer, but they find multiple functions for many components of milk that were formerly assumed to have had single functions. And Hamlet is a really good example of a protein that can be either a food or a killer. And we used to think that proteins only had one function, but it turns out that dependent on the shape of Hamlet, it's either going to become a killer or it will be a protein food. A mother's breast milk is unique to her baby, meaning that if she has a premature baby, she's going to make milk that's good for that premature baby's brain and immune system, and it changes to suit that baby, and it even changes throughout the course of a day, believe it or not. It does way more than flex a muscle. It's pretty much a miracle in the making, yet many mothers don't know that. But how could they, when scientists are only just beginning to understand the functions? But one thing that's becoming blindingly obvious to scientists and anyone who reads breast milk medical papers is that human milk contains factors that are capable of programming the infant's developing immune system and metabolism into a health-promoting model. Yet it does way more than that. It can heal and it can rebuild. I've got papers showing that a wet nurse without a disease actually cured a genetic disease in a baby that was suckling from her. That's because of the messenger RNA and the microRNA. Trying to remember the author's name offhand. If I remember it, I'll tell you. Remember that placenta that I showed you before? Well, IRMAK, I-R-M-A-K. Scientists who understand how placenta builds a baby, particularly when it comes to microRNA and messenger RNA, realize that breast milk performs many of the same functions as the placenta did in pregnancy. So, one big key to a baby's genetic destiny is the fact that a new mother's mammary glands take over from the placenta to provide the developmental guidance to ensure a baby's genetic destiny is fulfilled. It's setting the baby up for the perfect development. Now, this doctor who said that was the guy who developed discovered them. So let me remind you that breast milk is 100% alive, with millions of live cells, including stem cells, microRNA, messenger RNA, cancer nukers, immune primers, bacteria, viruses, probiotics, proteins, carbohydrates, oligosaccharides, fats, and all this stuff that we just seem to think of most of the time as food, at least I used to, and most of the medical literature did as well. So the natural bias of breast milk is anti-inflammatory. You should all get that by now, as well as having key roles in epigenetic modulation and immune system education, particularly relating to tolerance, meaning that the baby's not going to react strongly to things that it shouldn't be reacting to. So let's look at how vaccines might impact the natural programming of the anti-inflammatory bias that nature has set forth for millennia. Before we do, though, we need to discuss a major flaw in scientific thinking, which is that scientists and doctors think about the newborn immune system like that. There's a concept that on one hand, a baby is so vulnerable immunologically that it needs vaccines to survive. But on the other hand, it's stronger than an ox, and according to some doctors, they can tolerate 10,000 to 100,000 vaccines all at once and will do no harm whatsoever. And there's also the idea that vaccines will make a baby stronger. It turns out that neither one of these are true. This thinking comes about partly because of flawed assumptions as to what a baby's immune system does. In reality, a baby's immune system looks like that. It's a fully developed, gleaming race car with a top-grade computer with an extra program on top of that adult program, which temporarily clamps it down for a very important reason, as well as an inbuilt security blanket. What is it? There she is. When that baby meets a threat and starts to react in an inflammatory way, the breast milk is right there to kick out pathogens from inside and constantly redirect the immune system to react to the minimum degree possible. There's an article by Pabst in 1997 that shows that if you vaccinate with measles, mumps, and rubella, a breastfed baby or a formula-fed baby, their immune profiles are completely different. Okay? The breastfed baby keeps being brought back into the anti-inflammatory state. The clamps are an extra program superimposed upon the baby's normal immune system for two very specific purposes. And to do that, a baby's immune system has to be anti-inflammatory. Those two purposes are that a baby needs to develop good gut flora and be gradually exposed to food and other potential allergens via the environment and through breast milk, which is the best way for a baby to learn what's safe and what's not. Both food and other allergens are processed by the mother and presented to the baby encapsulated in breast milk constituents, which tag those things as safe. All the scientists who study breast milk and neonatal immune system in depth know that the developing immune system is highly susceptible to modification and disruption by environmental influences, and it's at significantly greater risk than the fully matured immune system of an adult. The same applies in all mammalian species. In terms of milk, modulation of the immune system, but what's important for us is that numerous unique immune maturational events are programmed into specific windows of prenatal and neonatal development. These maturational events are building blocks on what subsequent changes in the immune system are built. The discovery of these specific windows is very important because they're windows of opportunity whereby certain maturational and developmental events are programmed to occur. At every window, a baby can go the right way or it can be derailed and go the wrong way. And in the last 3 years, I've become very aware of the fact that the medical model's constant interference in this process is sending our children in the very direction we don't want them to go. And it can be very difficult, if not impossible, to fix these derangements or make up for lack of proper events during these specific windows. But because the baby's default program is anti-inflammatory, one thing we know they don't cope well with without breast milk is infection with encapsulated bacteria. Most breastfed babies cope brilliantly. And this has been documented since, I think, the 1920s or 1930s. But why is it that babies don't respond well to encapsulated bacteria? Because this is, after all, the reason that these bacterial vaccines are being mandated. Well, first up, as I said, breastfed babies do cope very well. Human milk has that thing called Hamlet, which goes in like a rampant frontline army with bayonets and mows them down. However, formula-fed babies don't have that kind of infantry cover. The design of the infant immune system depends on breast milk to cover encapsulated bacterial infection, and this is the risk the baby takes to ensure successful development of the brain and the immune system. That's the risk that nature took to have a baby develop normally. However, for decades, formula has been considered to be as good or nearly as good as breast milk. Many pediatricians have little idea of the complexity of immune protection from breast milk. They have no idea of the genetic modifications which microRNA and messenger RNA conduct in breast milk, and even what that cow microRNA in formula might be doing. Most of the children they see with encapsulated bacterial infections are formula fed, and little thought is given to why that is. I hear so many cases of mothers who want to breastfeed in the hospital, and because the doctors and the nurses don't think she's making enough, they insist upon topping off with a bottle of a formula. If you give a baby formula, their gut flora changes for 2 weeks. Our breastfeeding rates in America are pathetic. And I know most of you are probably breastfeeding right now, and hopefully, you know, even the World Health Organization recommends to exclusively breastfeed for 6 months and to continue at least partially for 2 years. And that's really important, and it should become obvious now why that's so important. Instead, doctors' primary thinking is what can we inject into babies to stop these infections? But if they understood neonatal immunology and breast milk a bit better, they might ask, why are we not making sure these babies are being fully breastfed? So the next logical question is, what might happen if you try to help a neonatal immune system protect itself with a vaccine, especially when the baby is pre-programmed to dampen inflammation? This is important because we know that in children who do have competent immune systems, vaccination is still a trauma of considerable intensity. This study was from 1967, and you're probably not going to see another one like this, but Dr. Del Campo studied 200 children over a 5-year period. They were given all different kinds of vaccines, and he looked at them in many different ways. And just to briefly summarize, and also in 1967, the vaccination program was a fraction of what it is now, and children were vaccinated at older ages, okay? But this is still what they found. He documented adrenal stress, high levels of acid production, massive inflammation, derangements in clotting and bleeding factors, lipids that went haywire, they went up and then they went down, and sometimes they didn't go down, and heart rhythms that went off track. So what happens if you do this in babies that are supposed to be in their anti-inflammatory window of opportunity? After all, we know that a baby's immune system doesn't want to respond this way. Pediatricians, however, refer to this programmed non-responsiveness over and over, and so does the medical literature, as inadequate, sluggish, defective, weak, and in need of correction. They want to make it respond like an adult. So, what do they do to make it respond like an adult? They give vaccines with something in them which throws a red alert switch and forces a normal baby to respond whether they want to or not. The process goes like this. Injection of aluminum adjuvanted vaccines, most of which are to your babies, into a muscle, not eaten, not intravenous, but injected into a muscle, that's very important, causes the release of uric acid, DNA, and cell components from those damaged cells that the needle went into. And what that does is it turns on an inflammatory cascade, which is represented here. These inflammasomes get activated, help T helper cells come in, macrophages just continuing to eat aluminum and until they basically eat themselves to death sometimes, or they carry it off to other places in the body. Aluminum's mechanism of action as an adjuvant is still not fully understood, even though it's been used in vaccines for over 70 years. What is known about the mechanism and about the overall effects of aluminum is very disturbing, and it's also well documented in toxicology literature and in independent medical research literature. Basically, aluminum sets the immune system on fire to accomplish what the antigens couldn't do on their own. If you inject a baby with a pneumococcal vaccine that doesn't have aluminum, the baby won't respond to it because it's programmed to be anti-inflammatory. So the aluminum is basically to override the baby's and even an adult's anti-inflammatory predisposition. The problem with this is that while vaccine promoters do their best to brainwash people into thinking that aluminum is essential for healthy growth, I've even seen vaccine promoting doctors that are quite famous say that it's necessary for normal gestation, they also say that it's easily excreted. Well, that's just a lie on wheels, which is whipped around the globe while no one appears to have a clue where to look in the science to find out if it's actually true. And guess what? It's not true. Scientists in 2013 say, although traditional aluminum-based adjuvants have been used in humans since the 1930s, there's still not enough information about the manner of their actions. So, if there's not enough information about how aluminum acts, how then is it possible to say that it's safe? The simplest way is to say nothing and rely on the fact that most parents don't ask questions and don't go and look for answers themselves. They think, well, the mercury's gone, that's good. Well, guess what? The aluminum is nowhere near gone. It's much higher levels than the mercury ever was. When parents do ask, they discover not only is little known, but the action of aluminum, but worse, there's plenty of evidence explaining in considerable detail some of aluminum's many known dangers. And one of these dangers is related to what we're talking about with epigenetics, the interference of epigenetics in the cell membrane. Remember what I showed you that? Well, the interface of aluminum damage is exactly at the same place, in that cell membrane. We know that cell membranes and myelin are affected by aluminum. And this is just a schematic of a cell membrane and some of those proteins that are sitting in there. And aluminum goes in there. So have a look at this membrane and consider that each cell, as I said, has around 100,000 switches that open and close it to various substances and affect the inside and the nucleus. Then consider the fact that after aluminum exposure, the cell membranes and myelin become stiff and dysfunctional. And these are the references up here. Verstraten talks about this in detail. And you can get that article online. Aluminum is a death signal to cells. It's not a nutrient, it has no place in the body, and it should never, ever be injected into a muscle. Another pediatric fallacy of the past is that a baby's blood-brain barrier is impermeable. It's not. And when it comes to aluminum, neither is yours. This is a schematic from an incredible article by Kawahara from 2011. And he shows that in Trojan, and not only him, but many other authors have shown that in Trojan horse fashion, aluminum does cross the blood-brain barrier in macrophages and with other carriers that shuttle it across. Kawahara's article is really important because it supports, with 176 scientific references, the fact that aluminum is a death factor for cells. Aluminum binds to phosphorus in DNA, and it influences various genes, as we talked about epigenetics, which can be influenced here, but also things can be turned off or shut off here. It also binds to ATP, which is depicted right here, and impairs energy production. Remember, ATP is the substance that gives us energy in the mitochondria. It displaces calcium and magnesium on enzymes. Enzymes won't work if they don't have the proper minerals and cofactors. And it basically makes the enzymes useless to do their enzymatic work. And worse than that, it increases the half-life of aluminum in the body because it's still hanging out there on these enzymes. It damages cell membranes by catalyzing this peroxidation reaction. And that's just the beginning of the havoc that aluminum causes. Remember that cell membranes control how genes function, how the inside of the cell functions, how cells talk to each other, whether we grow, whether we die, whether cells differentiate into organs, or whether they turn into cancer. So the question we need to ask is twofold. Why do we have so many vaccines containing aluminum? Why are there no other safe or effective adjuvants being used? The medical model says that aluminum is safe in babies. This article says we need safer adjuvants. This is an article, I think this is just from 2013, actually. While the body is able to excrete aluminum in its natural form, the element aluminum, like mercury, is toxic to all life forms when concentrated in their tissues. How would aluminum concentrate in tissues? It just wouldn't be excreted rapidly like we're told that it is. The kidney function of a baby bears little resemblance to that of the 7 healthy adults that were used to justify the vaccination of all babies with aluminum. Kidney function is a very important detail left out of the discussion. As a nephrologist, I know a little bit about that. And as you can see on this chart, it can take as long as 2 years for babies to gain peak kidney clearance, or kidney function, and in the first 3 months, none of them has peak kidney function. And at birth, look at how low it is. If greater than 90 is normal, between 2 and 8 days, the average is 39, and the range is from 17 to 60. There have been 2 analyses looking at whether or not aluminum at current dosing is safe or not. And it's important to look at both of these studies to analyze how the authors came to their conclusions. The first is this Keith from 2002. Keith used only part of the total vaccine aluminum schedule in the calculations of whether or not the ingested and injected aluminum surpassed these theoretical minimal risk levels for babies. So this is the minimal risk level line, and these are the injections, and this is formula and breast milk, okay? And we know that aluminum is in formula and it's in breast milk, okay? It shouldn't be, but it is. And here's the spikes right there that go through that minimum risk level during the time of vaccination. So what happens to the brain, nervous, and immune systems in these conservatively estimated 3 days? Also not taken into account is the cumulative body burden of aluminum, especially in infants with lower than normal kidney function, which is a common occurrence, as I just showed you, up to 6 months and can even happen up to 2 years. Well, this analysis grossly underestimates the aluminum excess to infants. It certainly doesn't take into account the aluminum that the mother was injected with the hepatitis A vaccine, hepatitis B vaccine, and DTaP vaccine that are recommended to them now. But someone in the pro-vaccine world must have realized that Keith's study had the potential to cause trouble if someone thought about what might happen to that graph if you added in all of the vaccines and considered the kidney function. So in 2011, a group of talking heads came up with the most extraordinarily assuming science since bloodletting. I'm glad you're all sitting down, because using the same flawed assumptions that Keith did, Mitkus took on the question of aluminum toxicity in infants and said that he included the low filtration rate in kidneys in babies and the higher vaccine schedule. And he magically came to the conclusion that it's even better than Keith said it was. Look, the aluminum level is down here, and these are the minimum risk levels. This is called dismissal by wand waving. So let's have a closer look at the wands and the fairies that were involved. Just take a quick look at the 3 points here, and you'll see why the minimal risk levels are fictitious. Because they used a minuscule single dose of aluminum to 0.7 micrograms, okay? Consider that your two-month-old baby will get 1,200 micrograms of aluminum injected intramuscularly. They used 0.7 micrograms on a full-grown man with normal kidney function. And later they did it to 6 more people to track the aluminum excretion. They used an intravenous dose, which does none of those inflammatory processes that I mentioned. It would go right to kidneys and be filtered. And it would not have behaved nearly as maliciously as an intramuscular injection. They also used a form of aluminum called aluminum citrate, which has never been a form of aluminum in vaccines. Then they simply followed the blood and urine levels of radio-labeled aluminum. Included in some animal studies were rodents, they used the radio-labeled aluminum for the intravenous, and then they did separate studies where they fed rodents high levels of aluminum and determined this minimum risk level from rodents and these adults that I'm talking to you about. They made this comment about monkeys. They said, towards the end of the article, if infant monkeys, an infant monkey study could provide these data, meaning more accurate data. However, given the present lack of evidence of harm due to the current aluminum levels, such studies may be a low priority. And of course, doing monkey studies would be a low priority, because if they did them and found that aluminum was causing trouble, they were coincidentally linking with other things, or calling it idiopathic, which is what I see happening most, the vaccine companies would not only have to reformulate vaccines, but they would have to go back to the start and complete millions of dollars worth of phase testing for safety and efficacy. Neither the vaccine manufacturers, the FDA, or the CDC would ever tolerate that. And here's proof. This was a study from Dr. Thomas Jefferson. I used to have a PMID number on here. I think this was from 2007. And what they did is they looked at, they did a meta-analysis, meaning they looked at studies that had already been done, comparing people who had had diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis vaccines to those who hadn't, just that one vaccine. And they determined that despite a lack of good quality evidence, we do not recommend that any further research on this topic is undertaken. This was the Cochrane Collaborative Database, an independent research conglomerate. Why would they say this? Well, they gave away why they said it later in the article, and I'm just going to read to you what the article said. It's one paragraph. They said, replacement of aluminum compounds in currently licensed vaccines would necessitate the introduction of a completely new compound that would have to be investigated before licensing. No obvious candidates to replace aluminum are available. They tried squalene in the Gulf War. That didn't work very well. They also tried it over in Scandinavia, and there was an epidemic of narcolepsy. So withdrawal for safety reasons would severely affect the immunogenicity and protective effect of some currently licensed vaccines and threaten immunization programs worldwide. And we all know what else it would threaten. This type of commentary is made repeatedly. It flies in the face of reason. Well-established and peer-reviewed independent publications are ignored time and again. I have many more examples of such blatant denial, but not enough time to discuss it. I have a pile of papers down here with more of it. This is a real experiment done on pregnant and newborn animals, where aluminum was injected into the mother, and it was also eaten. And then the animals were dissected after the mother gave birth to them. So the mother was dissected, and the babies were dissected. Sad that we have to do this to show some common sense. And it was they were all euthanized and dissected around the time of a human equivalent of 1 to 2 years to see where the aluminum actually went. Now, doesn't that make much more sense than creating a fairy tale mathematical assumption? It showed that blood levels may be showing the best case scenario. Now remember, blood levels are what they're talking about when they talk about this minimum risk level. Blood levels are down here, brain levels are up here, liver levels are up here, and kidney levels are up here. Okay? And bone, I think, is even higher than that when it comes to where aluminum is deposited. So looking at only blood levels and the excretion times of aluminum, as these former theoretical analyses did that I just went over, ignores the damage that's done at time zero when that vaccine is injected and the tissue deposition that occurs throughout the body. This study also showed that adult rat brains, in those adult rat brains, the aluminum level was 1% of what the liver levels were. But in the fetuses, the aluminum level was 30% of what the liver levels were. And they concluded that the fetal brain is an aluminum sink. Instead of doing meaningful primate studies, theoretical calculation studies and meaningless human experiments are done so that aluminum can be defended and so that industry can be protected, not so that your children can be protected, not so that you can be protected while you're pregnant. And this is what I mean when I talk about reductionist science. Infant health is determined by a very complex interaction between environment, which is a complex thing on its own, and the human body, which is a very complex thing that's still not well understood. So it's not scientific to study a single aspect, the tunnel view of aluminum toxicology in adults, for instance, and automatically extrapolate those findings and theoretical conclusions about infants using minimum risk levels. I love Oscar the Grouch. Then there was this study done, the interpretation of which will boggle the mind. This was actually a good study because what this doctor did is looked at two-month-old infants after they received the usual 1,200 microgram aluminum dose for the three intramuscular vaccines. The aluminum was given per the usual infant schedule. And then what she did is she measured the blood levels of these babies and the urine levels of aluminum over the subsequent 12 hours, because we're told that the aluminum is rapidly excreted within 12 to 24 hours. This paper said that they were relieved to notice that no significant change in levels of urinary or serum aluminum were seen after vaccination. And I read that and I thought, why are they relieved to see that? And I wrote this doctor, and I queried her, and I told her about the problem with low glomerular filtration rates of infants, and where is this aluminum going, and what's happening. So let me just summarize here, is that they injected these babies with aluminum, they didn't see it rise in the blood, and they didn't see it come out in urine. So you can put that equation together, right? Her reply to me was, "We don't really know what happens to the aluminum at this point in time. As you said, more research is needed in this area." And I wrote her back again and sent some more studies and some more questions, and she hasn't written me back. So with all that in mind, have a look at this nasty partial list of aluminum's known effects on the body. When I say partial list, I have about four more slides that I could have put on here. But I just boiled it down to some of the things that I think are really important. These scientists are not the only ones sounding a warning about the potential results of aluminum in neonates. Another group who recently banged the gong is Kang in 2013's group, who didn't seem too pleased. The study showed intramuscular injection of aluminum-containing vaccine was associated with the appearance of aluminum deposits in distant organs, such as the spleen and brain, where they were still detected 1 year after injection. I have two folders full of papers which describe in intricate detail the known and proven toxicities of aluminum throughout the body. Dismissing all that literature, vaccine proponents continue to reassure parents that aluminum is no big deal, and they base these reassurances on junk science or on no science at all. The problem with aluminum is that its efficacy and its toxicity are one and the same. The same mechanisms that drive the immune-stimulating effect also have the capacity to provoke a variety of autoimmune and/or inflammatory adverse reactions. Repeated intramuscular injection of aluminum adds to the accumulation in cell membranes, lymph nodes, liver, spleen, brain, kidney, and bone. And when you go back and consider some of the windows of development that we talked about in immune maturation, the use of aluminum should take on a new importance. This Dr. Dietert wrote some really amazing articles that talk about these windows of vulnerability and all of the environmental, you know, problems that can occur during these development, but they never once mentioned vaccines. And this is just, it's a dangerous place to go for researchers, you know. Their grant money tends to dry up when they start, when they go there. But just to show you a little bit here is that we have, this is a two-year line. And right here we have conception and, I don't know that I can divide this up anymore. It says 5 to 7 weeks of gestation, 12 to 24 weeks of gestation, and then birth happens around here, and then this is the two-year-old baby. And just, you don't have to look at everything on here, but just know that each of these blue boxes here denotes immune cells in the brain that are developing at this period of time, okay? So they talk about these 9 developmental windows of the immune system. It's pretty amazing. Well, there was another scientist named Shel Varajan who for years was writing articles about the defective, impaired, weak baby immune system, and the light bulb went off for him. Maybe an apple did hit him on the head, I don't know, but he woke up to the reality that a baby's immune system is not an accident that requires fixing by vaccines, and he mentions that tissue growth and remodeling are taking place at a rapid pace, and so maybe that's why the babies are in this anti-inflammatory phenotype. And I think he's right. This is an example. This was given to me by a Merck vaccine scientist. Okay? So I don't have a reference here for you. But I've looked into this myself and found that this is all absolutely true in other scientific writings. So if you look at this graph, which shows gene expression of various brain cells, you can see that if you derailed any of these processes, it would be like throwing a spanner into the spokes of a child's bike while they were speeding down a steep hill. Gene expression is at a maximum for many types of brain nerves, even up to 4 years. So look at this. Two of them, one of them when you're born is up maximally regulated. That's this one here, cholecystokinin, which is about whether you're thirsty, hungry, whether you even know you are. Then you have these two gene expressions here at 3 months, 100% gene expression, which continues at 100% for just about 2 years. And those have to do with the ability to think and nerve excitation and muscle tone. And then at 4 years, 3 to 4 years, you have a peak in this one here, which has to do with motivational reward-related behavior. We know that inflammation and aluminum can alter normal gene expression. Keeping infants and children away from inflammatory influences is really important because where the damage occurs in the brain is in the microglia and the astrocytes, which are involved in every major aspect of brain development and function, including synapse formation, meaning how nerves talk to each other. What we have here is a schematic of a brain nerve, and then here we have migratory microglia. They can come in from the periphery. A resting microglia, this one here is activated, and you can see it's secreting cytokines. A fully activated one here, they change morphology, and then you have an astrocyte, which is another kind of immune cell. And it's really important that these immune cells upregulate and function when you need to, and that they turn off when you don't need them to work. And it's very tightly regulated, inflammation, anti-inflammation in the brain, and it's very important. Brain pathology is, to a large extent, a pathology of these immune cells called microglia. Cytokines, or these chemicals that are secreted by immune cells, are one of the largest and most diverse families of signaling molecules in the body. Under healthy conditions, most cytokines circulate at very low concentrations, but can increase up to 1,000-fold during trauma, stress, or infection. They can be both pro- or anti-inflammatory. They can work together for synergy, though after stress, they become pro-inflammatory. The brain is very sensitive to the proper balance of these cytokines. So what are some known microglial triggers? Vaccination stimulation, vaccination components, including aluminum, DNA, RNA, and protein fragments, which exist not only from the animals that vaccines are incubated in, including monkeys, cows, pigs, chicks, aborted human fetuses, just to name a few. There's mercury still in the multi-dose influenza vaccines, and there's still trace amounts of mercury in some of the other vaccines. Monosodium glutamate, which actually is in the inhaled flu vaccine, and also, as we know, is in food. And kind of gut infections are imbalance and inflammation also because of the brain-bowel connection, which we now know absolutely exists. It's very well documented now. But anyway, there's three references for you if anybody has any doubts that what I'm saying. All right. Now, in order to go on, I have to give you a little crash course in immunology. But it's not that difficult, so just hang in there for a second. This is a dendritic cell. I've spoken about dendritic cells, and I'm going to bring them up again. So remember the word dendritic cell. These are cells that are antigen-presenting cells, meaning when there's all that scanning of the body or when something comes in from the outside, cells have to come and sample it and then put a piece of it on the outside membrane to present to other cells to give direction as to what to do in the immune system. Okay? And like I said, 99.99% of the time, our bodies don't do anything unless there's a pathogen. So basically, they'll present the antigen to a naive T cell. And the differentiation that happens, that naive means that it hasn't differentiated yet, okay? And it depends on the cytokines that hit this, and as well as the receptors. It's epigenetic influences, basically. So we can go in several directions, and I just have three of them written down here, and I'm really only going to focus on two of them for now. So we can go up to a Th1, and you'll hear this mentioned all the time, Th1, and I think people talk about it and don't really know what it means, which is why I want to explain it a little bit to you. So this naive T cell can go into a Th1 profile, and T cells will predominate, and this is an inflammatory profile. And this is what protects us from pathogens, and it's what we want to happen when we're invaded by a microbe, actually. Then we have a Th17 profile, which is also an inflammatory profile. And then we have this over here. This is the Th2 profile. And this one is basically designed, and it has a purpose. It's not just all bad. The purpose of it is to protect us from intracellular pathogens, from parasites, and it actually activates eosinophils and is responsible for a lot of allergies. And we now know that aluminum and early antigen injection in a newborn can bias the Th2 profile over and above the Th1. But also, you should understand that, you know, nature didn't do any of these things by accident. They're all normally supposed to work together. And these two work when we have a high level of inflammation. It's Th2 cytokines are actually able to come in and tell it to shut down and that the job is done. Well, there are a few people that are taking this very seriously, and what they're finding should turn a few heads. What I'm about to show you is a study done on mice by Dr. Zaghouani and his group in 2010. What he did is he got newborn mice, and he injected them with antigen. No aluminum at all, just antigen. And he injected them when they were very young, obviously. Now, these are dendritic cells here. And they are specifically immature dendritic cells. And normally, as an adult, if you get injected, you're going to make massive amounts of interleukin-12, and something different will happen. But what happened to this one-day-old mouse is that it only made little bits kind of sputtering through this interleukin-12. And I mentioned to you before that a baby's immune system is fully capable of responding. It can respond through Th1, and it can respond through Th2. The thing is that if it's stimulated early, you get this funny receptor on the Th1 cell. Okay, so just hold on for a second and know that we've got antigen injection, we've got the Th1 cells coming about, and it has this funny receptor. Baby's vaccinated, everything looks fine, it makes antibody, nobody knows there's a problem. This is really important because all reactions and problems don't occur and become obvious right away. Then they revaccinated the same mouse as an adult. And what they found was that, again, it mounted a Th1 and a Th2 response, But because of the way it had been programmed earlier, the Th2 cells basically killed off the Th1 cells. Homicide. Now, this is the second part of the experiment. What they did is they looked at different days, and they found that on day 6, something special happened. And so we have the one-day-old mouse that we did not vaccinate, and we waited until day 6 when there were a much more variety of dendritic cells, and they had different kinds of receptors. They were a much more mature array of dendritic cells. And they vaccinated that 6-day-old mouse. And what they found was normal reaction, is that they had nice high levels of interleukin-12, normal Th1 and Th2 development. And then later, when they re-stimulated with the same injected antigen, they had a normal Th1 and Th2 response. This is important because what he saw in these mice is what we see in the outcome in humans. When the vaccine is done early, even with just an antigen and no adjuvant, in one of those windows of opportunity, something interesting happens, as I just showed you. So now you can see how the abnormal response in the adult occurred because, as a young mouse, it was vaccinated with just antigen, injected antigen. That's important. This involved, and they discussed this, an epigenetically hypomethylated area on the immune cells, which is part of that clamp system that we talked about. So now you can kind of put it all together, why I went through all those things in the beginning. So in this case, the mouse vaccinated too early had its immune system skewed towards Th2 and can do nothing about it for the rest of its life. And you might say, well, okay, let's leave it until kids get older if that's a problem. Well, also, I just want to say that a 0 to 6 day old rodent is estimated to be around 0 to 8 months in human years, okay? Well, the problem is that every age carries different problems. And in children, other problems can arise, as we saw in this study done on 18-month-old children in Africa, looking at the top genetic networks that were epigenetically altered after the diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis vaccine. You don't have to read this, because I'm going to summarize this in a minute. They did this because in Africa there was a little problem with DTP-vaccinated girls. They had a higher mortality than the unvaccinated girls. So they decided to do this study and look at what genetic networks were upregulated or downregulated. And this is just a chart from the actual article. And you can see there's a big array of changes. Each one of these is a different girl. The one-size-fits-all vaccination program that's recommended to you does not act uniformly. What this study proves is that after a vaccine, you're not just going to get a fever and a sore arm and immunity, because different genes are activated in different people. The same genes we turned up in some girls were turned up in others. Sorry, turned down in others. This showed that not only is our disease susceptibility different, but susceptibility to vaccine adverse effects is also different. So it makes no sense to have a table of injuries that will be compensated for, such as the vaccine injury courts use. In practical language, what do all these epigenetic changes point to? A whole array of possible future trouble. And this is a partial list of the top genetic networks that were altered after vaccination with diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis vaccine in these 8 girls. But there's something else here. Because in these girls, so many different genes were tripped and no combination was the same between them, any possible vaccine reactions would also look unique to that child, which flies in the face of the dogma that for a reaction to be a reaction, the same reaction must be seen in all children because the same vaccine was given to all children. This is a major flaw in thinking, because if the same vaccine triggers different genes in different children, it stands to reason that the biochemical changes in each of those children will be different. So if you want to know what the immunological explanation is for the gene changes that happen after DTP and DTAP, I can't tell you, because even Orntoft in 2013 said they haven't studied it and they don't know. But if you want to follow common sense and work on the principle that a gene alteration just might not be a good thing, then anyone with half a brain might be able to work out what the consequences might be. McDonald published this study in 2008, which showed lower rates of asthma in children whose DTP vaccines were delayed. So this was a study of 11,531 children who received at least four doses of DPT vaccine. They were assessed at age 7 by going through medical records. And what they found was that if the first DPT vaccine was delayed, that if it was delayed more than 4 months after birth, they found that instead of having a rate of asthma of 13.8%, there was a rate of asthma of 5.9%, which is less than half. If the second one was delayed, it was less dramatic, 13.5 down to 6.8. Remember, we have the clamps on here. We have this anti-inflammatory phenotype that's supposed to be happening, right? So here, these are going to be like Zaguani's mice and be susceptible to being skewed into a Th2, which is an allergic profile, okay? The third one as well, 13.3 went down to 8.3 if the third dose was held. And they commented that if all the doses were held, that the rate went down to a further 60%. I actually sent a letter. I tried to communicate with these doctors, and I got one of the lab, it was a postdoctoral lab fellow who really didn't want to have anything to do with me and said, oh, that was the DTP vaccine, and we don't use that one anymore. And she really seemed afraid, actually, to be talking about this article. So you can justify it and say, well, it was the DPT, and we don't use it anymore. We use the DTAP. But guess what? This study in 1998 found that there was 10% more atopy using a cellular pertussis vaccine than the whole cell vaccine. So don't think McDonald's still doesn't apply. This was Nielsen 1998, and these were the actual numbers from the chart, and the interpretation of that was that there were 10% more atopic subjects in the DTAP than there were in the DTP. This is an amazing study by Laudenpera in 2008. They looked at five human infants that had had all their vaccines on time, a DTAP, a polio, and the Haemophilus influenza B. And then blood was drawn from each of these infants at 6 months. Then the blood cells were re-stimulated with pertussis toxin outside of their bodies. And then they went through sophisticated genetic techniques to analyze what genes were upregulated and what genes were activated. Remember I showed you that gene, how it can unfold and open up and start making proteins? Well, that's what they looked at. And the following results were noted. 12 hours later, after that stimulation with pertussis toxin, which is basically what's in, it's one of the antigens in the vaccine, DTAP, 33 allergy-related genes were activated, 66 asthma-related genes were activated, 67 cancer genes were upregulated, and 25 immunological disease genes were upregulated. I find that kind of mind-boggling, and I think this really tells you that having a totally vaccinated versus totally non-vaccinated study really needs to be done. Because if we're upregulating cancer genes, probably most of them will go back to sleep and they won't develop cancer, but we don't know how many of them will. This was a Japanese study, which I actually have in Japanese, but another author interpreted it, Mari, in 2004. And this was a study that comparatively evaluated the presence of allergy symptoms in a very homogeneous cohort of 82 subjects that were aged human subjects between 0 and 3 years old. And 43 of them had not had the DTP vaccine. And they showed a remarkably low prevalence of allergy in the non-vaccinated subset. Okay, so this is the non-vaccinated, and this is the vaccinated. Asthma, rhinitis, atopic dermatitis. The black bar shows presence of symptoms, and the white bar shows absence of symptoms. So in the unvaccinated, these are the ones that had absence of symptoms, and these were the ones that had presence, and these are in the vaccinated. And they concluded by saying monitoring of the adverse vaccination events should also consider the long-lasting immunologic effect of compulsory procedures. And if we didn't vaccinate for 12 months, if we just stopped vaccinating for this vaccine for 12 months and looked at the population, that's basically what this study did, this is what would happen, according to Hurwitz. We would see 50% fewer asthma cases, 45% fewer sinus cases, and 54% fewer allergy episodes. But not only do we vaccinate, we continue to pile in more shots as if they're as wonderful as breast milk. What might the further consequences of turning babies into needle cushions be? Systemic autoimmunity. This Dr. Sumiyama actually caused lupus and numerous disease-related autoantibodies to occur simply by vaccinating without aluminum, giving them 8 to 12 vaccines in mice. And he showed how the T cells transform to become self-directed cytotoxic lymphocytes and how autoantibodies are induced. And this is important to understand because it goes to the heart of what we're talking about in early infant years, developing tolerance. And that's why it's so important, because autoimmunity happens when something pushes the body beyond its limit, as Dr. Sumiyama showed. But it also happens when the immune system overreacts to a microbial protein that's the same as something in the body's own infrastructure. This doesn't only happen in babies either. What's the basis of this faulty identification? Okay, so you're colonized with bacteria and viruses. And your immune system has been trained, say if you're normal, your immune system has been trained to be tolerant. The bacteria and the viruses, and even a tetanus toxin, actually contains so many of the same protein networks that are exactly similar to yours that your body is trained to not react strongly on a regular basis, okay? So remember I said earlier that if I were to vaccinate a baby without aluminum, it wouldn't react, and that's why, because of tolerance that has been induced. But if you toss aluminum into that vaccine, it's a whole different story. And then you run the potential of if a protein is exposed somewhere and you've now had your immune system cranked up to be hyperinflammatory towards a protein on a microbe that matches a protein in your body, then your immune system has a likelihood of attacking your own body. And that's part of the basis of autoimmunity. Dr. Kanduk in Italy has been writing a lot about this, and it's unbelievable that this isn't getting more publicity, in my opinion. She wrote with Dr. Trost in 2010. And the title of the article is "No Human Protein is Exempt from Bacterial Motifs," meaning the protein sequences, not even one. So this is how we can be loaded with viruses and bacteria that we tolerate, and this is what can happen if we react to it after an aluminum-stimulated vaccine. So this is why we have clamps on the immune system during that period of infant colonization, so this doesn't happen, so that we don't react to normal bacteria and can thus set up normal mucosal lining and a normal immune system. But vaccines and antibiotics and many other drugs interfere with this normal protective network, and they have the potential to set up autoimmunity. So let's just look at one vaccine and what the autoimmune possibilities might be with that vaccine. Remember here that one vaccine will not trigger the same gene upregulation in the same children, remember, from Orntoff that I just showed you with the DTAP in African girls. The reason for that is that the body picks the antigen at random based on what's exposed to the immune system. So these doctors wrote about these autoimmunity and molecular mimicry phenomena. And what they said was that even a tetanus toxoid, which is in the DTAP vaccine, this is just one example, has peptide similarities with beta 2, glycoprotein 1, cardiolipin, phosphatidylcholine, and double-stranded DNA. I'm going to spare you the first two explanations, but just tell you that cardiolipin is actually on the inner mitochondrial membrane, so you really don't want to be attacking that. This one here is related to antiphospholipid antibody syndrome, if you've ever heard of that. But phosphatidylcholine is actually the substance that creates the outer membrane of every cell in your body. Double-stranded DNA is DNA in your nucleus. So you can imagine now, if you have created a situation where you're normally tolerant to this, But then you go and inject a tetanus toxoid with aluminum, which these vaccines have, and you've geared the immune system up to go against these microbes that it has a strong potential to auto-react to the outside of your cells, to your mitochondria, and to the nucleus genetic material. This is a problem. And some of these papers down here talk about the correlation between encephalitis and seizures and different autoimmune diseases with vaccination. So now you know that a baby's immune system is not defective or immature, that it's developmentally programmed and age appropriate. In terms of real health, too many parents have witnessed their children having multiple holes punched in the complex network of immunity and brain function. These parents are raising a generation with the highest level of immune disordered sicknesses and brain diseases ever seen in the world. A sick child is a sick family, a sick bank balance, lost joy, and high divorce rates. Thinking that a vaccine can be made better and safer is putting the cart before the horse. So long as we ignore the blueprint of the 3-year pregnancy, parents will be robbed of healthy children, their money, their enjoyment, and their freedom. Their children will be robbed of their birthright, their health, sometimes their ability to work, and possibly their own ability to have healthy children. All because some might say fools rushed in where angels fear to tread. And this is my last slide, and I just now, after all that, ask you to ponder if you would like to disrupt the programming of an infant immune system. And you have to also now, you can say, well, I'll just wait and do it later, but I also would ask you to understand now that what you've been told is only part of the story, and some of it has actually been told to you intentionally wrong. So given that is true about infant immune vaccinations and vaccinations during pregnancy, we have to reassess what we've been told about vaccinating children, vaccinating our teenagers for human papillomavirus, and for meningitis. We have to reassess this whole hype about flu vaccines every year of life from the age of 6 months to death. And that's the end.